Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Petroleum accounts for 40% of the current total energy use in the United States. Proponents of biofuels say that all of that petroleum can be replaced entirely in two decades with biofuels. For thousands of years, civilization's main event, the harvest, has focused our attention on the fruit of our agricultural efforts, the kernel, the grain, busheled and bagged. In 2007, the competition for corn as a biofuel, in addition to food, drove up the price of corn, and some experts say that's put the poor in jeopardy. Corn ethanol is astonishingly inefficient. We'll find out about that. Some corn ethanol plants closed this year. Others, which are planned, were put on hold. So in the biofuels race, where do we go from here? We'll get an answer from David Crass, who is the managing partner of the Madison office of Michael Best and Friedrich LLP. He served as chair of the firm's Land and Resources Practice Group from 2003 to 2005, and today coordinates its Agribusiness and Food Special Practice Group. David has provided strategic counsel to numerous existing and startup operations in the burgeoning biofuels industry, and it's a pleasure to have him here at the microphone. Hi, David.
Good morning, Jim. Pleasure to meet you.
I hope all of this that I've said so far meets with what you understand as well as this biofuels business.
Right. It's a very exciting time to be at the center of a lot of these developments, and of course, we sit here today. This program could not be better timed, given that President Bush signed today the Energy Independence and Security Act, which Congress passed both last week and then earlier this week in terms of the House. And it really does set forth a very aggressive biofuel development that is going to go on throughout the country, and Wisconsin is at the heart of it.
It seems to me that when this bill was being pursued, there was a target of about 35 billion gallons of alternative fuels by sometime in 2015-17 or so. In this bill that was signed, did they meet that target or exceed it, or what happened?
Right. Jim, there were two very significant developments that this bill will move forward. One is, for the first time in 32 years, we had an adjustment to the what are called the CAFE fuel economy standards for motor vehicle fuels, the corporate average fuel economy, and that was to move those fuel economy standards up to a goal of an average of 35 miles per gallon by 2020. That is one major element of the bill. The other thing that the bill does is it establishes a renewable fuel standard, which is what you were referring to there. Which would result in an increase to 36 billion gallons of ethanol and other renewable biofuels to be accomplished by 2022. And those are of course, graduated in. By 2008, we'd be looking for 9 billion gallons of ethanol and renewable biofuels. And the key there that I want to emphasize is the concept of renewable biofuels. It's not just corn-based ethanol, but rather beginning in about 2016 under the bill, a significant portion, again on a graduated scale, to meet that standard must come from advanced biofuels such as cellulosic ethanol.
We're talking with David Crass, and if you'd like to join in, we have lines open for you at 263-1890 or toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. So that big question then is, how do we break down cellulose is the research question that is being addressed right now. But let's just talk about ethanol in 2007. I saw a number this morning. I think that it was something like 6 or 7 plants existing in Wisconsin, with another 10 or so on the drawing board as we approached December. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's more or less right. Now, that's always a moving target in terms of the number that are on the drawing board. We do know that we have in Wisconsin about more or less 250 million gallons of production online. And the estimates are that we will double that by the end of 2008 if many of these plans come to be, so that we would have about 500 million gallons of ethanol production in Wisconsin by the end of 08.
Where do you see this question about food versus transportation in terms of corn ethanol?
Food versus fuel is, of course, a raging debate right now, although I can tell you that a study was just released very recently, authored by Informa Economics, which sort of highlights that it is a very complex question. I can say this much about the issue of, you know, rising food costs. And the argument, I should back up, the argument is that, of course, the demand for corn as an ethanol-producing feedstock has driven or gone into competition with that same feedstock for our food. What this study shows is that actually the corn price fluctuation with respect to consumer food prices is a very small percentage, about 4% attributable to that. Now, the reason for that is that the farm commodity value of the input of corn into food is only about 19% of the total food cost. 81% of food cost is driven by such factors as labor, packaging, transportation, energy costs. You know, we've seen, of course, crude oil go from $30 a barrel up to $80 a barrel and beyond. And so that energy cost has a direct impact on the cost of food production as well. These studies do show is that, and I think anyone in the ethanol business would not deny that there is some impact, but it is not as simple as a straight line comparison between the cost of the corn, you know, input going up and then a resulting increase in food. In fact, when you look at our nation's corn crop, in 2006 we produced about almost 11 billion bushels of corn, and only about 17% of that corn went into ethanol production. The vast majority of corn that is produced in this country never leaves the farm. About 50%, 51% stays right on the farm and is fed to livestock. So you're talking about a smaller percentage of 50% that remains being driven into the ethanol production.
David Crass is our guest as we talk about the biofuels industry in Wisconsin. And if you have a question or comment that you'd like to bring up, give us a call. In Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. The price of corn went over $4 a bushel. The price of wheat over $10 a bushel. Does the impact of the wheat have any impact on what happens in the corn field?
It does. A lot of these commodities tend to track each other, and that's certainly true historically with respect to soybeans and corn. And just to pause with respect to soybeans, for example, we do know that we've got a developing biodiesel industry that is one of the main feedstocks for biodiesel, which is a replacement for petroleum diesel, as opposed to ethanol, which generally serves as an oxygenate for gasoline. That the demand for biodiesel has spiked up the price of soybean oil as an input. Now, when you crush soybeans, you typically are crushing soybeans for livestock feed, for the meal, and the oil tends to be a byproduct. Well, there's a bit of a shift or a decoupling in terms of that fundamental assumption, and you're seeing some speculation by buyers buying up soybean oil stocks, as an example. And so, whereas historically you could peg these commodities relatively closely in terms of fluctuations in the marketplace up and down, we're starting to see some decoupling depending on what the feedstock is and depending on what the purpose.
All right, let's go to the phones, take some calls. Rick in South Range is our first caller. Hi, Rick, go ahead.
Hi, interesting program. I understand that the energy bill has a significant increase in ethanol, and that presents a bit of a problem for me. I have an inboard-outboard engine on my boat, and I was having some difficulty with it dieseling, running after I shut the key off, and I took it into the Barker's Island Marina up here near Superior, and they told me that I shouldn't be using any fuel with ethanol in it, and not terribly surprising, the fuel that they sell at their dock did not have ethanol in it. I did find a BP station in Superior without ethanol, but it's the higher grade. The engine doesn't require higher octane, but it's the only one I could find without ethanol in it. And the engine runs just superbly. Is there anything in the future that might address that issue?
Yeah, unfortunately, being a lawyer and not an engineer, I really don't know anything about the application of ethanol blends to marine outboard engines. We have a very vibrant small engine industry in Wisconsin, and so I know that I can tell you that those engine manufacturers are tied into this whole discussion and debate. So that to the extent that this poses any kind of a problem, increased ethanol blends with respect to other types of small engines, I know that that issue will be addressed. But I'm sorry, I can't really give you a direct answer to that question.
Well, let me try another one on you, although you've already admitted that you don't want this, this isn't your area of expertise, but have you heard anything about the Prius running less efficiently with an ethanol blend? A friend of mine's got one, and he was most disappointed with it. 40-some mile per gallon drop to the high 20s.
Well, I can address that in part. We do know that ethanol blends tend to have the benefit, definitely, of being cleaner burning. It's an oxygenate, so it's more efficiently burning, and it reduces tailpipe emissions and overall greenhouse gas emissions when compared with straight petroleum gasoline. There were some studies originally that suggested that any blend beyond E10, meaning a 10% blend in an overall mix of gasoline, would lead to fuel inefficiencies. There have been recent studies, however, that show, in fact, a study released as recently as November of 2007, that suggest, and this study, the work was done primarily, as I recall, at the University of Minnesota, which suggested that blends of up to E20, E30, or meaning 30% ethanol content, actually get a better fuel economy. Even in non-flex fuel vehicles. Flex fuel vehicles are, of course, those vehicles that have undergone an engine conversion that can withstand, if you will, E85 or 85% blends or more. So I can't speak specifically to the Prius or what happened to your friend, but I do know the developing area of the developing science on this, and the studies that have come out more recently actually suggest that blends of up to 30% ethanol can result in better mileage and better fuel economy than even in traditional non-flex fuel vehicles.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Rick, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. I know that there was a new kind of biodiesel plant in Cashton that was starting up. Have you been working with that?
We have not, but I'm certainly aware of it. Our firm has a significant practice in this area, and we represent most of the ethanol producers in Wisconsin, and certainly represent ethanol producers throughout the upper Midwest and down into Missouri and Georgia, et cetera. I can mention, though, with respect to the best plant in Cashton is an example of a very exciting thing that I think you're going to see replicating in this area of biofuels. And that is, even in the straight corn dry mill ethanol industry, we are seeing such innovation and the application of greater and greater technological development tied into our technology industry that's spun out of the University of Wisconsin and other sectors to make these plants more energy efficient and to get more out of the kernel corn, or in the case of BEST, to apply a technology to really energize the production of what they're attempting to do, all toward greater energy efficiency with respect to the production of these biofuels, as well as becoming, the lowest cost provider. And that's what these industries are driving toward.
We will continue our conversation with David Cross, the managing partner of the Madison office of Michael Best and Friedrich LLP, as we discuss the biofuels industry in Wisconsin. That'll be coming up after a look at all of the news from National Public Radio in Washington. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's good to have you along with us today as we continue our discussion with David Krass of the Madison office of Michael Best and Friedrich, LLP, about the biofuels industry in Wisconsin. David, in his practice, has provided counsel to numerous existing and startup operations in the burgeoning biofuels industry. You can find out more about what they do if you go to their website, michaelbest.com. And again, David, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today about biofuels.
It's my pleasure, Jim.
We were talking before the news about ethanol and the number of plants coming on. Also talked about a new kind of biodiesel plant in Cashton, which taps corn oil, the waste from corn ethanol plants. You wanted to make a point, though, about all of the opportunities for biofuels and its relationship to what's going on right now in the study of greenhouse gases and climate change.
Certainly. I think that that is we have a confluence of events which have led to this significant policy support and public support for investment of public resources and significant private resources into these developments. And chief among them, in my view, is an increased focus, of course, on climate change and humans' role in exacerbating that problem. The benefit of, or a direct benefit, one of many direct benefits, including rural economic development, et cetera, of biofuel development is the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions. And there is really not a lot of debate with respect to that issue. Ethanol, for example, both the National Renewable Energy Lab and the Argonne National Lab estimate that ethanol production reduces, as compared to petroleum production, greenhouse gas emissions by up to 30%. So, and other forms of biofuels do even better than that. So that, I think, is an example of many policy initiatives coming together to justify a significant commitment. And certainly, Governor Doyle has shown a lot of leadership on that issue here in Wisconsin.
If you'd like to join the conversation with David Krass, the number is 800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison, use the local number at 263-1890. Let's go to Robert in Coloma, and Robert, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Yes, hello to both of you. Mm-hmm. Regarding ethanol from corn, I heard three different experts on Wisconsin Public Radio during the years saying that if all of the corn now grown in the United States was converted to ethanol, it would only be about 5, 10, or 15% of the fuel now being used. Seems we have such a long way to go that we should start thinking of something other than corn.
I think, let me react to that in two ways. First off, with respect to 2007 production alone, where we expect nationally to produce about 7 billion gallons of ethanol, that actually results in about a 4% replacement of total gas consumption. We consume in this country about 140 billion gallons of gasoline every year. So those numbers are likely with respect to contributing all the corn grown, I mentioned 11 billion bushels across the country, to ethanol production. I think that number would be closer to 20%, but it's certainly not 100% to the caller's point. And what I think you have seen here is a recognition. I don't know that there ever was necessarily an assertion that corn ethanol alone could wholly replace that 140 billion gallons of gasoline that we consume each year, 70% of which is imported, by the way. But what we have seen is an acceleration of policy of investing to look at other feedstocks. So the caller's point, I think, is a very good one, and I think we're already doing that. The Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, headquartered here at UW, is an example of that, where the Department of Energy is investing just here alone $130 million. To establish this lab, the sole purpose of which is to find other feedstocks to produce these biofuels than row crops.
Robert, thank you very much for bringing that up and making the point. And Rick in Sturgeon Bay is next. Hi, Rick.
Hello, thank you. My question is, have people really investigated the integrated systems you mentioned after making the ethanol, pressing corn oil out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Then can you feed that maybe to cattle and use that as cattle feed and then take, for example, take the manure from the cattle and make that into natural gas, and then the effluent from the biogas generator makes a good fertilizer? Have people really looked at doing these things in an integrated way?
Yes, there have been a couple of very interesting proposals that are essentially closed loop systems, as you mentioned. There was one of these that it was located in Kansas, and there are a couple of more that are located in the farther west that are located on, you know, co-locate the ethanol plant with a livestock production facility and have a closed looped system. They have met with a variety of success or failure in part due to the volumes of livestock that you need to sustain the volume of ethanol production. But I will say that the whole concept of further processing, not only on the front end, let's take corn ethanol for an example. There's a lot of work being done looking at fractionization of the corn kernel, extracting greater value on the front end of the milling process of the corn. Then, on the back end, as you mentioned, the corn oil extraction, Verisun and U.S. Bioenergy Corporation just announced that they are merging, and one of the key factors that is driving their merger, which will result in the nation's largest ethanol producer if it in fact closes, is the use of this corn oil extraction technology to improve the overall ethanol economics. And as we see a greater crunch, if you will, in terms of the squeeze ethanol producers find themselves in, the lowest cost producer will survive. And what that means is those that can not only extract the most value on the front end going in, but also deal with all of the co-products on the back end, the distiller's grain and the CO2, which results in addition to the ethanol, those are the ones that will win.
Thank you.
All right. Rick, thank you very much for the call. Our guest is David Crass, the managing partner in the Madison office of Michael Best. He has provided counsel to numerous existing and startup operations in the biofuels industry. One of the problems with corn ethanol is its inefficiency. As I understand it, vast amounts of fossil fuel are required for its manufacture, and so that every one unit of energy nets a mere 1.3 units of ethanol. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's actually, I think the studies have gone all over the board on that topic, but most people in the industry have alighted on 1.34 to 1 in terms of a net energy balance. Now, just to put that in context, when you look at biodiesel production, which I mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. that's about a 3.2 to 1 return net energy balance. Sugarcane, Brazil is the second largest producer of ethanol in the world, right behind the United States. And sugarcane has an 8-to-1 net energy balance. So, and if I go even further, LG, which is in the development, research and development mm-hmm, stage, mm-hmm. Including some work that's being done here on the University of Wisconsin campus, would be off the charts in terms of net energy balance. So it is true that with respect to ethanol, first off, there is very little debate to no debate that there's a net energy deficit with respect to ethanol production. That is not true with respect to petroleum production, by the way. But so with respect to ethanol, there's at least a 34% kicker, if you will, in terms of a net energy balance. But there is a recognition by ethanol producers, and again, it goes back to this cellulosic feedstock question, that there is promise that down the road there would actually be a better return on investment from an energy unit basis.
All right. And we'll talk more about that as we go along. Mike in Delafield is next. Hi, Mike. What's on your mind?
Hello, Jim and David. Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I'm coming up on Maguanago now and my Prius, and I can tell you I drive two Priuses. My wife has one as well. And the ethanol-based fuels deliver about 2 miles per gallon less than the pure gasoline that we like to get. One of the main point that I wanted to make here is probably something that you don't have a lot of control over, David, but just wanted to get the word out that not everybody out there really appreciates ethanol in their gasoline. I am an avid pilot and have flown airplanes for years that burn auto gas. As a matter of fact, I specifically own airplanes that burn auto gas because they're so much cheaper to fly. Of course, the airplanes that burn auto gas cannot use gas that has ethanol in it. It is not in the certification of that airplane to use that. So I'm in the habit of driving to Dodge County. I live in Oconomowoc, so drive to Dodge County, pick up my gas, and put it in my airplane and my boat and that sort of thing. So my big problem is that I really have no real gripe with ethanol as an additive into fuel, but I would like for it to be an option for the consumer and not be shoved down our throat with the legislation as it is right now. I've always felt that the ethanol industry is a product looking for a market. And with all the dollars that go into the pockets of politicians every election cycle, from Archer Daniels, Midland, and the other ethanol producers, I'm just very much afraid that it's going to be legislated into every county in Wisconsin and all over the country, and it would put me and a lot of other people in a big bind.
Well, I think what the caller identifies is that there are, of course, always legislative trade-offs that are made. There are winners and losers, and sometimes, they're not equally divided. I can say that about 70% in all the studies that I've seen, 70%, there was a recently released Harris poll that said 70% of the American public supports congressional action to promote the use of biofuels and ethanol included within there. It'd be interesting to do the net energy balance on driving to Dodge County from Oconomowoc for airplane fuel. I don't know about that. But what I can say is, right now, with respect to ethanol, is not the silver bullet. It's not the cure-all. Biofuels are not today the cure-all, but they are moving us toward a goal of more energy independence. And if you compare the caller's point with the fact that we are essentially exporting $20 billion worth of U.S. wealth to an unstable part of the world on a monthly basis to simply satisfy our petroleum needs, I'd submit to you that some inconvenience along the way is well worth the investment.
Thanks very much for the call, Mike. We appreciate hearing from you. One of the problems in corn ethanol is the transportation system, the pipeline, and how is that going to be solved? What's first of all, what are the problems of corn ethanol in the pipeline, in these holding areas? Some corrosive activity, isn't it?
Sure. It is the problem that there is not a national ethanol pipeline system. The fact of the matter is that the delivery infrastructure is a significant bottleneck to ethanol distribution across the country. Ethanol is primarily trucked and trained. So when you compare it with how other petroleum products are delivered from the coasts, it is an inefficient process. It is a process, though, that I think policymakers are now aware of that infrastructure and delivery problem, and I would expect there to be some action in that regard. I think that infrastructure delivery is a problem that infects the biofuels industry at large, because the parties that control that delivery infrastructure are of course the petroleum industry, from not only the pipeline to the distribution terminals to the mixing rack. And we have seen a number of positive developments in terms of the relationship between ethanol producers and biodiesel producers and the oil industry, and I would suspect that with this congressional support and the public support that will continue to make progress toward getting the product to the consumer.
Back to the phones to Jen in Madison. Hello, Jen.
Hi. A few months ago, I guess it was, I read an article that was covering a study that apparently concluded that a number of biodiesels produced nitrous oxide as a byproduct, which is apparently worse than carbon dioxide. And I was just wondering how much of a concern this is as far as how green biodiesels are, and if that's been discounted or if it's not true, that sort of thing.
It has been. That was a concern. There's no question about that. So what you're recalling correctly. But by and large now, as the science matures, what we're seeing are more and more studies coming out that actually look at that issue and have pretty much opined that biodiesel does lead to an overall reduction I should say that the National Lab has come out and said it is NOx neutral. Some studies say it's NOx deficit. Some studies say that it's nitrous oxide benefit. But by and large, the national labs have come out and said that it is NOx neutral. It is a significant reducer of carbon monoxide and also particulate matter. Particulate matter is the fine soot particles, which often cause folks. Asthmatics and other air quality concerns, and biodiesel is a significant reducer of particulate matter as compared with petroleum diesel.
David, if I gave you $1,000 today and said invest it in biofuel research, where would you put your money?
Well, I don't answer that kind of question, Jim. I would put my money in algae research, quite frankly. I would say algae research with respect to that as a feedstock, as well as research that's going on to deal with the CO2 created by biomass conversion, cellulosic conversion into biofuels. This is an issue that I think is going to have a lot of publicity on, and I know it's an issue that folks at the Great Lakes Lab are focused on, and that is when you take cellulosic material or biomass, and of course our goal is to take 1 billion tons of this stuff, be it wood waste, corn stover, any kind of biomass, and you convert it into biofuels. There is a CO2 byproduct, if you will. Now, it's a better CO2, if you will. It's a younger CO2 because it comes from recently grown plants as opposed to CO2 extracted from a carbon-based petroleum fuel from deep in the earth. But what a lot of researchers are looking at is how do I take that CO2 and attack it with microbes and break it down further in a second stage type of reaction. So if I had $1,000 to invest, I would invest it in one of those two places.
And if you wanted more information about the algae fuel energy boom, there's a couple of websites. The National Renewable Energy Laboratory is one of them, and that is NREL.gov, the National Renewable Energy Lab, NREL.gov. More information there about what's going on with algae fuel. Let's go next to Jim in Oshkosh. And Jim, what's on your mind today?
Oh, good afternoon. I just recently read an article in our local newspaper here, and the title is Corn's Rise Equals the Gulf's Death, and they're talking about the Gulf of Mexico.
It was just in the New York Times this morning is the story.
Yes. Well, what's happened is the corn demands a high nitrogen fertilizer to grow. It's been running off. A lot of the fertilizer runs into the Mississippi River system, and over roughly 8,000 square miles of the Gulf is dead over the past decades that this is going on. And I was wondering if that's the case, is there some other crop like switchgrass that I've heard of that may use less nitrogen fertilizer, or maybe even that you can mow like your lawn and it keeps growing or something? What do you think about that?
Well, I think that is an excellent point, and it's a point worth pausing on. There is no doubt that there is an impact from sediments and organic material, if you will, or inorganic fertilizers on the Gulf of Mexico. This has been something that has been going on for a very long time. This has been a problem for, you know, at least, as the caller points out, decades. And the sources are not only a non-point source type of pollution from agricultural production, but also lawn care and golf course care and all of the all of the contributors to a nutrient load down to the Gulf of Mexico. What we are doing is we do have an integrated approach on this, and that is to look at all those sources and to try to not only educate the public from the standpoint of the phosphorus use on their lawns down to comprehensive nutrient management planning that agricultural producers are now going through. And we're seeing some positive impacts as a result of just being educated on those ultimate impacts. To the caller's point about whether there are other crops that are available for energy production, I think that's the whole message here, is clearly corn-based ethanol is in my view an excellent way to produce that biofuel. There are others, and there are more efficient ways down the road. What we hope to do is to unlock some of those secrets of switchgrass, of corn stover, et cetera, of this cellulosic, essentially plant wall material, and other types of energy crops that can be grown and potentially grown in a less intensive way with respect to the soil structure that would then allow us to take what is a good idea, and that is the production of energy from essentially sunlight, which is what the whole concept is here, and apply it with respect to different feedstocks that are perhaps less impactful on the environment. Corn has been grown, of course, since the settlers, and so that's going to continue. The concerns of a lot of environmentalists is corn being planted in you know, critical areas or highly erodible lands or that sort of thing because of the pressure to fulfill this demand. I can tell you that biotechnology, in terms of increased yields on our existing acreage, the data clearly shows that is helping the problem as well.
And again, we'll have to leave it on that note. Jim, thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry we can't get to the rest of you who are online and waiting. We will continue to talk about the biofuels industry and research in Wisconsin on about a monthly basis, so we'll have another program coming up in January. Our thanks to David Crass, the managing partner of the Madison office of Michael Best and Friedrich LLP. And if you would like to find out more about what they do in the way of biofuels, you can go to the website, michaelbest.com. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Jim, and happy holidays.
Thank you. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with UW-Madison folklorist Jim Leary about his award-winning book on Polkabilly, How the Goose Island Ramblers Redefined American Folk Music, here on the Ideas Network.